Welcome to the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm Megan Kamrick. This week, the Army Corps of Engineers announced it would not allow the Dakota Access Pipeline to be drilled under a portion of the Missouri River. This was a major victory for the numerous Native Americans and their supporters who've been trying to halt the project near the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation. The struggle against the pipeline has galvanized Native activists around the country, including those in New Mexico, who are concerned about the impact of the proposed crude oil pipeline right here in home in Chaco Canyon. Chaco National Historic Park is a UNESCO World Heritage Site, but it's still unclear what will happen with the Dakota Pipeline when a new presidential administration takes office. How do you see the fight against the Dakota Access Pipeline impacting New Mexico? Are you concerned about environmental impacts from energy development in your community? What about the potential for jobs that new energy projects might bring? On today's show, we'll talk about what's happening in North Dakota and how it's reverberating in New Mexico. We will have today on the phone Dwayne Chili Yazzie. He's the president of the Shiprock chapter of the Navajo Nation. He helped organize veterans to travel to Standing Rock. Do we have him on the phone? Not quite yet. Okay, well, we will go with our guests here in the studio. With me in the studio is independent journalist Laura Paskus. She has covered environment and energy issues in New Mexico extensively. In late 2014 and into 2015, she did a series called Drilling Deep about oil and gas in the northwest corner of New Mexico. You can find a link to that at KUNM.org. Laura, have the events in Standing Rock altered any of the issues that you covered in northwestern New Mexico in that series, or altered how people are responding to energy projects?
I think probably the biggest thing that's changed how people are responding is kind of the drop in oil prices right now. So from my understanding, things aren't quite as active as they had been at the time I was reporting. But I think one interesting thing for New Mexico is it may have sort of brought to the fore this sort of issue of different people coming together on these issues and people paying attention maybe more to Native and land and energy issues than they had been in the past.
Can you explain what people mean when we have a phrase that comes up? It's called an energy sacrifice zone. I heard that a lot when I read through your series and talked to people for this show.
So the way that I think about that is a few years ago, there was a big fight when there was proposed energy development in the Galisteo Basin, when there was talk of development in Sandoval County recently, people became really actively opposed to that sort of drilling activity in areas where lots of us live, places we go past all the time. The rest of us don't always pay attention to is there is a lot of energy development in the northwestern part of the state where the population's much smaller, where it's, a lot of Native people living there. And so there's, there are coal mines, there's coal-fired power plants, there's a lot of energy development
And mining.
And so I think, it's worth it for those of us who live in cities and in the suburbs to remember that there is all this development going out in areas that we should be paying attention to, not just our backyards.
Can you explain also when we're talking about northwestern New Mexico, we talk about a checkerboard landscape?
Sure. It's complicated.
That's why I'm relying on you, because you know it so well.
Some of our other guests might want to help out with that. But basically, there's the Navajo Nation, sort of the main part of the reservation, but there's also individual allotments that they're considered private lands, but they belong to Navajo families. So they don't have the same I don't want to use the word protections, but they don't have the same sorts of regulations or oversight that the main part of the reservation does. That's under the overview of the Navajo Nation.
And so the idea is when people are on Navajo allotments and they might accept money to let their land be used for drilling or exploration. Some people might not. This sets up sort of this, conflict zone where some people don't have access to a lot of money otherwise,
right.
And someone's offering $60,000
Right. It depends where you live and, you know, not just the land ownership, but what resources might be available and how accessible that area is. But I think it has, you know, whenever you inject inject a significant amount of money in an area where people are making daily decisions about their budgets, it does set up a very interesting dynamic between family members and among, you know, people living in the same community.
We want to hear from you. Did you travel to Standing Rock? Have you been following what's happening there and thinking about your community here? Are you concerned about industrial impacts from mining or pipelines or other energy projects in New Mexico's native communities? Or do you think we need to pursue more oil and gas projects to create more jobs in the state that desperately needs them? Join the conversation by calling 866-899-5866 or tweet at KUNM News. I am also joined by the Victoria Barr here in the studio. She's the Farmington Area Manager for the Bureau of Land Management. And John Halliday is here. He's Deputy Director of the Bureau of Indian Affairs Navajo Regional Office, pardon me. Victoria, talk about the role of the BLM in energy development in these northwestern New Mexico communities and how events in North Dakota are changing how agencies are working with tribes.
Sure. So the energy development in Northwest New Mexico is married into the mission of the Bureau of Land Management, which was established by the Federal Land Management and Policy Act in 1976. And that act essentially said that BLM needs to manage these resources for multiple use and sustained yield. So we manage a variety of resources anywhere from grazing to recreation, wilderness, cultural resources, and in Northwest New Mexico, oil and gas and mineral development. And so the United States owns the mineral rights subsurface in the majority of the western states. And so as part of that, the BLM is charged with managing those mineral estates through what's called onshore orders, which were designated by Congress. So essentially, the BLM is responsible for leasing oil and gas or fluid minerals on BLM and Forest Service administered lands, and then also processing what's called applications for permits to drill, which would be affecting the surface. And so for us, in Northwest New Mexico, we process the APDs on BLM-administered lands, as well as the APDs that are processed for BIA-administered lands, which would include the allotments.
Now, can I turn to John, who's sitting next to you? You two have, you're both agencies, Bureau of Indian Affairs and the BLM, have been holding meetings in the last month or so about energy development in Northwest New Mexico. What were those about?
Those were about the the resource management plan amendment that would analyze the tribal lands and potential impacts of mineral leasing developments. We've traveled out to the chapters, which are the government entities for the reservation. They're kind of like counties for the reservation, where they have a government, you know, that has an area in which they have a constituency, and we travel out there and talk to the people who live in that area. There are approximately 17 in the planning area.
Now, is this, I think this is a first, Victoria, you can answer. Is this unusual that you two have come together to hold these, are they scoping meetings? Is that what they're called?
Yeah. So originally, the BLM Farmington Field Office, which is part of the district I manage, published a notice of intent in 2014 to initiate what's called a resource management plan amendment. That would amend the 2003 resource management plan, which are essentially the guiding planning documents for any field officer district. And so around 2012, with the uptick in the markets and additional exploration requests, the managers at the time decided it would be prudent to take another look at our RMP to make sure that we had enough what's called decision space to issue an additional number of APDs, given what industry had been projecting at that moment. So
tell me again what APD means.
Application for permit to drill, which is an extensive application process with lots of environmental analysis associated with it. But so when we started to take a hard look at the area, we kept coming into what Laura referred to as the checkerboard. So we have Indian allotted lands, which the BIA holds a trust responsibility for. So the United States essentially has title to those lands, and they hold those resources in trust for the individual allottees. And so as part of that, those lands also fall under federal regulations. So the BIA also needs to comply with the National Historic Preservation Act, the National Environmental Policy Act, any type of orders or rules that are published in the Federal Register in the 25 CFR specifically. Those affect mostly the Bureau of Indian Affairs. So they do have to have that level of compliance. And so because the BLM processes the drilling permits on Indian allotments, the BIA does the leasing part. And after it's leased, then the BLM comes into the picture to process the drilling permit. We felt like to really do a thorough job would be to look at the resources at a landscape scale. So kind of across administrative boundaries, we're both sister agencies in the Department of Interior. So we thought, why don't we work together? We'll serve the resources better. We'll serve the people better. We'll uphold our trust responsibilities better if we're working together to take a hard look at the resources and potential impacts.
Laura, I know you've been covering this area for a long time. I want to put you on the spot for a minute. Do you think this represents a change in the way things have been done in terms of how the agencies are involved in giving permission to drill or explore on these lands?
I think it's really exciting that the BLM and BIA are working more closely together. At least, I mean, maybe we're working this closely together behind the scenes and it's just more public now. But I think that's really exciting and interesting. And, you know, sort of before we started the show, Victoria and I were talking about how the agency is making a real effort to make sure that meetings are held in Navajo as well as English and printing materials in Navajo. So I think it seems like the agencies are really trying to respond to the questions that so many people have. Before I was a reporter, I was a consultant who worked on NEPA issues. And as somebody who's sort of worked in that field and also covered it, the law, the framework that everybody has to work within is what it is.
I am going to return to that in a minute because we have Dwayne Chili Yazzie on the phone. He's the president of the Shiprock chapter of the Navajo Nation. He helped organize veterans to travel to Standing Rock recently. Mr. Yazzie, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay, great. I'm so glad you could be with us this morning. Mr. Yazzie, how do you see what's happening in North Dakota relating to your Diné community around Shiprock?
Our thought is that the troubles that our Standing Rock Sioux tribe relatives are confronted with are the same kind of troubles that we should be anticipating here on Navajo. So it just only makes sense that we are in solidarity with Standing Rock, and because it's one and the same issues of the disrespect for the Earth Mother and what our people think about that.
Now, the Army Corps made their announcement after a weekend of veterans joining with others to protest against this pipeline. Do you think the presence of the veterans, and some of whom came from your community, had an impact on the situation?
We certainly want to think that we made an impact, and I think that the federal United States government needs to respect our veterans and to understand the reason why our veterans would want to make that position known. So certainly our veterans did make an impact.
Now, the tribal chairman of Standing Rock, Dave Archambault, has asked people to return to their homes. Some haven't been able to because there's a terrible blizzard that's been going on. So some have left, but there are others saying they're going to stay because they claim they need to. They're worried about the incoming administration. Some say there's still drilling going on. Have you heard from any of your members of your community who went up there? Are they still up there? Are they coming back?
We have a good number of our Navajo people up there. I'm not certain on the count. Before our contingent went up there, we were counting approximately 100 people. And the group that went up there last week, there are some that stayed. So I'm really wanting to know the numbers that we have up there. Of course, with the very cold weather up there and the difficulty of communicating with people inside the camp certainly leads to the uncertainty of how many people we have there and just what the sentiment is there now. But in terms of the warriors who are determined to stay there because of just the unpredictability of the situation and the blatant declaration by the pipeline company that they will continue to do their drilling in spite of what the Army Corps has stated, this leads to the need of our indigenous people and supporters to remain vigilant, and I certainly respect and honor those warriors and all of the supporters that there are.
We have to take a quick break. Mr. Yazzie, please stay on the phone. This is the KUNM Call-In Show. We'll be right back to talk about energy development in Native communities and the impact of the Dakota Access Pipeline protests in New Mexico.
Support comes from Outpost Performance Space, presenting the Michael Anthony Paul Gonzalez Project, Claudio Toulouse, Shoutout Redux We the People, and more, December 6th through 10. Info at outpostspace.org.
Program support comes from Slate Stern, trial lawyer providing personal injury and commercial litigation in New Mexico since 1994. Slate Stern believes that every client matters. More information at slatestern.com.
This is the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm Megan Kamrick, and today we're talking about how the events around the Dakota Access Pipeline are reverberating here in New Mexico in terms of energy development and Native communities. How has the police response in North Dakota affected you or your community? Do you think we need more safeguards in place to protect sites like Chaco Canyon, or do we need more development and jobs? Is there a balance in there somewhere? Call now, 877-899-5866, or email callinshow@kunm.org. I want to go back to Dwayne Chili Yazzie. He is the president of the Shiprock chapter of the Navajo Nation. Mr. Yazzie, we have folks here in the studio from the BLM and the BIA. We were talking about the meetings they've been holding about this master leasing plan, and I wanted to get your take on it because I think you attended one or two of those. I just was wondering if you think this represents a change on how lands might be leased in your community. What was your thoughts on those meetings?
Well, the effort to have a dialogue is certainly a long time in coming, maybe 100 years later. But we have to question the sincerity of the effort because we understand that much of the permitting process and other preparations are already in order to do a pipeline. And we understand that BLM is already advertising the auctioning of public lands that certainly might include the Chaco Canyon area. So we just have to question the sincerity of all of this. But nevertheless, we will engage in dialogue and see what we make of it.
Okay, give me a minute. I'd like to turn to Victoria for a response.
Sure. Just to clarify, right now, excuse me, we have deferred any oil and gas leases that would be administered through BLM within a 10-mile radius around Chaco Canyon. And so the land status around Chaco Canyon is fairly complex. So within that 10-mile radius, the BLM administers roughly 19% of the minerals, and then the BIA administers the majority of those minerals. For BIA to lease any Indian allotted minerals, the BIA needs to receive 51% of the allottee ownership status for consent to lease those minerals. So if there's 100 owners of an allotment and 52 of them object to leasing those minerals or won't approve it, then those minerals aren't leased. And so with the Indian allotments, the leasing process is very different. For the BLM minerals, Congress has essentially directed the agency to hold what we call lease sales quarterly across various states in the West. So we can make a decision through our NEPA process to defer leasing minerals or to lease minerals, or to lease minerals with stipulations such as no surface occupancy or limited surface use if it's a sensitive habitat. There's various things we can look at. And so also we can defer the leasing until we fully analyze it in an environmental impact statement. Excuse me. And in that EIS, we can decide whether or not to permanently or to close an area to fluid mineral leasing. I shouldn't have said permanently because it could be reopened in the future. But so that closing of those fluid minerals would be, active for the life of that EIS, which is approximately 20 years. And so there's a lot of analysis and process that goes into a decision before either the BLM or BIA leases any fluid minerals or solid minerals.
John Halliday with the Bureau of Indian Affairs.
Megan, I'd also like to point out that saying that a pipeline would go right through Chaco Canyon is kind of a misnomer. Chaco Canyon is a national park. And so the thought of that this is going to go right through a national park is not true. But there is a area around Chaco Canyon National Park and about 10 miles area where there's no development. It's because it's a culturally sensitive area and affects the viewshed, those kinds of things. But you also have to think that there are tribal landowners there who can't develop, who can't get any water, can't utilize the land that they own, which is, they're landowners and they can't use their own land. It's kind of difficult for them when other people are able to use their land and just because they happen to be next to a national park. So we get both sides, cultural protection, but as well as land ownership rights arguments.
And in terms of the Pinyon Pipeline gathering system, so approximately almost 2 years ago, in December and January of 2014-2015, the BLM had a series of public scoping meetings. So this is not a government-driven project. This is a proponent. The Saddle Butte Company came in with an application. The BLM is one of our multiple uses processes rights-of-way applications across public lands. So they came in with an application of a proposed pipeline gathering system to transport the oil that was being produced in the Lybrook area down to around Thoreau. The proposed route would go through BLM-administered lands, BIA, and allotted administered lands, as well as a good chunk of private land. Right after the scoping period ended, and we received approximately 30,000 comments, the price of oil went down considerably. The company at that point indicated that because of the decline in the commodity prices, it wasn't making the project economically feasible for them. So for all intents and purposes—
That might change if oil prices go up.
It could change, but essentially right now the project is on hold. If prices do go up, and they see that the market conditions are favorable, they might ask us to consider to pursue the application again. So it's, as I said, it's proponent-driven. We don't have a decision yet at all as to whether or not we'd approve the pipeline or where it would go.
I'm going to take, we have some calls I'd like to go to. We have Maya in Albuquerque. Maya, what would you like to say this morning?
Yes, I just want to say a comment. I've been to several of these scoping meetings myself, and to update this resource management plan that was from 2003, never analyzed the impacts of fracking and oil and gas development in the greater Chocolate area. And, you know, there's just overwhelming consensus that oil and gas development is having really negative impacts on the communities that are living out there, to land and water, and also social implications. And I think it's also worth noting that 91% of the lands in northwestern New Mexico and the greater area are leased for oil and gas development. So there's just a very clear prioritization of energy development over the other multiple uses that are in BLM's mandate to manage these areas for recreation and grazing. And I really think that that's something that needs to be looked at, and that the lease sale happening in 2017 just shouldn't go forward, especially when 91% of the lands are already leased for oil and gas. So we kind of have our own Standing Rock fight here in northern New Mexico, and that's to protect the greater Chaco area.
Thank you for that comment, Maya. I want to go to Carmen in Bernalillo. Carmen, what would you like to say this morning?
Hi, good morning. My comments are a bit about tribal sovereignty, which that word hasn't come up yet, and I know that in the checkerboard area you have different types of land ownership, but ultimately, when we're talking about sacred sites in particular, this is about cultural preservation, about our Religious Freedom Acts, and about tribal sovereignty. And that's an important aspect that really needs to be talked about sometimes, because we often want to make this about a state and tribal issue like they were trying to do up in North Dakota. This is about government-to-government relationships with the federal government. And if we also hold up proudly in the state of New Mexico our native cultural heritage, and if we're going to have hold up some of our Pueblos and Navajo and Apache communities as destinations for tourists to come and learn about our culture, we can't exploit the environment at the cost of saying, come watch our beautiful feast days and dances, and yet we're going to go ahead and desecrate the land upon which the native people here hold it sacred to them. So, you know, it's not just about environmentalism. This is about sacred sites, cultural preservation, and about religious freedom for indigenous people in New Mexico.
Thank you for those comments, Carmen. John had a comment real quick before you say that, John, because I know Mr. Yazzie has to go. Mr. Yazzie, I wanted to get one more comment from you. Do you think that what's happened in Standing Rock in North Dakota is changing the way people see environmental threats in Native communities, in your community?
The short answer to that is yes. But I need to expand to Mr. BIA there, just to keep in perspective the issue here, at least from our standpoint, in that you didn't hear me say that we're concerned about the pipeline going through the Chaco Canyon vicinity. I did not say that. Obviously, I don't see why that the protection, the buffer zone couldn't be greater than 10 miles. Why not 20 miles? Why not 50 miles? We're not concerned only for the Chaco Canyon heritage, World Heritage Site. We're concerned about the whole area. All of these lands, whether they're labeled BIA, BLM, private, et cetera, they are all Aboriginal lands of our Native Indigenous peoples, and we feel that we have every right and every authority to maintain our position in how those lands are going to be used. The second comment that I need to respond to that the BIA made here is that, legally these landowners have those rights and authorities to use the lands as they want. But I think that to clarify how that scenario works out is that at the onset of the fracking that began to happen here a few years ago, families, cash-poor families were persuaded to sign their lands away with checks to the tune of hundreds of thousands of dollars. You know, who's going to walk away from that? I think that there has been unscrupulous and underhanded means that have been used by the developers and federal agencies to get to where that's the state of development is. So there's so much discussion to be made here, and I can go further and talk about our questioning of the legality of ownership that is purported by BLM, BIA, and other so-called landowners in referencing the history of how those land designations were made. In our sense, and our position is that much of that land was stolen in the first place, beginning with the ill-fated doctrine of discovery. So I need to just make those comments and, be on my way, and there is much more to be said on this. Thank you.
Mr. Yazzie, I appreciate you taking the time this morning. That was Duane Chili Yazzie. He's president of the Shiprock chapter of the Navajo Nation. Mr. Halliday, with the BIA, you wanted to say something.
I just wanted to say that I appreciate what Mr. Yazzie has brought forward and what the lady earlier brought forward about tribal sovereignty and protecting tribal culture. I myself, being Native American and raised in our tradition, certainly feel the same way that tribal sovereignty, cultural traditions, and all those important things to the community need to be respected and protected. but that brings me to the interesting point of where non-Native government or non-government entities try and speak for the Indian people and, you know, kind of say they represent the Indian people when they don't really represent the Indian people. And as a government-to-government entity, the BIA needs to respect the wishes of the tribal government itself, and that the tribal government is a sovereign entity. And so we respect the legislators who speak legally for the tribe, who are elected by the people to speak for the tribe. And it's important that we remember that they have the jurisdictional authority on the land and are elected to speak on behalf of the tribe and make regulations and enact law over the tribal lands themselves.
We have a couple more callers, and I want to go to Roger in Albuquerque, who he says he spent a career in Indian energy. Roger, are you there?
Good morning. Yes, I am here.
What would you like to say this morning?
Well, first of all, I wanted to call in to say I really truly appreciate the professional commitment that Victoria Barr and the Bureau of Land Management have made to seeking out Indian country and the comment from Indian country. I know because I've seen I have a professional and personal vantage point of the commitments. When people talk about the sincerity of the Bureau of Land Management on this particular iteration of their work, I can assure you, if you look at their schedule, the Bureau of Land Management schedule to meet with Indian communities on weekends and on evenings and well past the government, 8 to 5 hour, they have gone above and beyond in this instance to really seek out the comment of Indian communities. So I wanted to start with that. Secondly, I think that the question that you were asking about the relativity of Chaco Canyon relative to the Standing Rock DARPA pipeline, I hope that there is no similarity between those two at all, in the sense that as a direct descendant of the Choctaw complex of the Pueblo people, you know, the 12,000 or so Pueblo Indian people and their 20 federally recognized governments that have been operating since the beginning of time, have a federal Indian relationship built on a trust responsibility with the federal government. I hope that these Pueblo governments would not allow all the plethora of environmental communities that have co-opted the Indian narrative in this country and really have taken it to a different level. We need our tribal populations. They're growing 4% per year, a doubling every 18 years. We need access to affordable, reliable sources of utility that includes oil and gas. Our economies, our tribal economies, that are doubling every 18 years, cannot possibly keep up without access to utility. So we need access to reliable, affordable sources of utility. We just don't want it, like any other American, we just don't want it in our water, we don't want it in our church, and we don't want it in our graveyards. I think any American would understand that sentiment. So there is a way, I think, to work with a very delicate balance of cultural preservation, environmental protection, and development of tribal economies. There is a way to do that.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much, Roger. I really appreciate those comments. It's a great way to pivot to Teresa Pascal, who's here in the studio with us. She's the former director. She's a former historic preservation officer at Acoma Pueblo. She's now an independent tribal consultant. And Teresa, in your work, you work with state and federal agencies to make sure laws are followed when archaeological sites or human remains are discovered. You've done that in the past. That's the National Historic Preservation Act, the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, the National Environmental Policy Act, which Laura talked about. They come up when there are plans to build pipelines, roads, or mines on ancestral lands. How did all this come into play in North Dakota? How is it playing out here in New Mexico?
Well, good morning, and thank you for having me. You know, I think over the course of many different years, we've seen various development projects come through, not just here in the state of New Mexico, but across the Southwest and across the country that have varying levels of impacts on communities. The gentleman caller prior was talking about his personal statement on development, and it highlights the complexity of development projects here in New Mexico, because we do have to find a balance. We do have to find a balance in which we can have development, but development that doesn't impede on the cultural resources of communities. Most of these projects, unfortunately, happen in communities of color, in communities that are economically depressed, as Chile was talking about earlier, indicating that there have been families that have been given financial sums of money. And that has happened across, not just here in New Mexico, but it's happened across the country. And so we have to look deeper at these projects. We also have to look at how Standing Rock and that particular movement at Standing Rock is going to have implications here for our communities in New Mexico. As Laura indicated earlier, I think it's elevated that conversation about how we look at the impacts to communities here in New Mexico and communities, especially our tribal communities, who don't have the ability to pick up an entire Pueblo or Apache community or Navajo community and move them someplace else should those resources become impacted. So when we're talking about water, we're talking about air, we're talking about land, we're talking about animals, the environment, everything that needs, that is there for the community to sustain themselves, once those resources become impacted, so does the viability of those particular communities. And so it becomes even more important for our people to become involved in the conversations that are happening with BLM about these proposed projects, but also to look at future projects, the renewable energy projects. There are no projects, even in green impact projects, that don't have an impact on the landscape and don't have an impact to community. We look at wind, we look at solar, we look at other alternatives. At some point, they all have impacts to community. The question is, how much, what percentage is it? And are those impacts ones that we can live with?
I just need to take a quick break. Teresa, just a minute. This is the KUNM Call-In Show. We'll be right back.
Didn't win the Volvo? You have 8 more chances to win a great prize. The International Folk Art Market donated 3 beautiful pieces, and Kim Ju Photography donated 5 $500 gift certificates. If you registered for the Volvo, you're already entered. If not, return your mailed entry card. Or you can donate and register at KUNM.org. Please don't wait too long. The winners of the $500 gift certificates and folk art prizes will be drawn on Friday, December 9th.
It's the sweetest time of year when cookies, cakes, and holiday variety of pastries come your way. For people with diabetes, saying no to all those can be difficult because cupcakes are just so tempting. On the next Native America Calling, we'll talk about tricks and tips to manage diabetes during the sweetest of celebrations.
Weekday mornings at 11 on KUNM.
This is the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm Megan Kamrick, and we're looking at the impact of the Dakota Access Pipeline, the protests, the decision this week by the Army Corps, and what it all means for energy development, particularly in Native communities in New Mexico. You can still call us at 877-899-5866 or email callinshow at kunm.org. We had one email comment real quick, said sacred land, let's get real here, sacred land means we own it. And Teresa Pascal, the Interior Secretary Sally Jewell, visiting your community today, Acoma Pueblo, as part of a tour looking at highlighting federal initiatives, including relations with Native American tribes. One of the main issues at the Dakota Access Pipeline was tribal consultation. The Standing Rock Sioux Tribe felt they were not given the opportunity to consult as broadly as the law requires. So do you think that federal agencies perhaps will now change how they do consultation with Native communities, perhaps as we're seeing with the BIA and the BLM?
I think tribes have long pushed the federal agencies to understand that consultation is not simply just checking off a box, checking off a list and say, okay, what do we need to get done within this process? Let's say that we consulted with X, Y, and Z tribes and our job is done. Let's move on to the next step in this particular development process. At the Pueblo of Acoma, in my time there as the Tribal Historic Preservation Officer, we often pushed back on agencies to get them to understand that those conversations, the deeper, more meaningful conversations that will help inform a lot of these processes and decision-making by the agency and ultimately then by the secretary, are those conversations that go beyond the timelines that are often put into play, say these 30, 60, 90, 120-day timelines often instituted by the agency. We also have, as tribes know, our own traditional calendar, which dictates to us when leadership changes, when we are available to talk. Winter time right now is a very difficult time to have conversations with tribes. Many of those tribes are in transition with leadership. They're closing out their years. I know many of our Pueblo communities here in New Mexico are bringing a close to their year. And leadership is getting ready to change. But also there are times when tribal communities don't talk about these sensitive cultural issues depending on what the season is. And so we have to get the agencies to understand that it may take longer than 120 days. It may take longer than the outline that agencies have already put in place to get certain things signed and moved along. But it can be done. it can be done. The Secretary's presence here in New Mexico, and especially this morning here at ACOMA, is a welcome visit from the Secretary. But I think that Secretary Jewell's visit really sends a message to tribes, and especially tribes here in New Mexico and across the country, that our cultural places, our lands are important. They are of vital importance to our American history. These are not just important to our history in our own community, but to the history of the United States. And that we, whether we work in agencies or as TIPOs or as activists in our community, we have an obligation to ensure the protection and sustainability of those lands. And so the Secretary's visit here to New Mexico, and under her tenure, the designation of numerous national monuments during her tenure is important. It sends a strong message to not only New Mexicans, but to the country as a whole.
I want to add in one more voice to this. Joining us by the phone from Taos is Eric Schlenker-Goodrich. He's an attorney with the Western Environmental Law Center. Are you there, Eric?
Good morning.
Hey, some experts say what happened this week with the Army Corps of Engineers decision, the Dakota Access Pipeline, will set a precedent for other Native communities in terms of energy development. Is that true, and what does that mean for New Mexico?
To a degree, it does set a precedent, but I think more importantly, what it reflects is the federal government taking seriously its legal responsibilities to Native communities and taking seriously its responsibility to take a hard look at the impacts of energy development and, most importantly, to consider alternatives to energy development. So in the context of Standing Rock, we're talking about alternative routes for the pipeline. That lesson, in particular regarding alternatives, is one that, frankly, the Farming BLM office, as well as the BIA, have not yet taken to heart. I think what's very interesting that's happening in the San Juan Basin, and where I hope we can see some change through the resource management planning process, is a serious consideration of alternatives. The Farmington Field Office has been more or less a runaway freight train in moving in one direction, and that is additional oil and gas leasing and additional oil and gas drilling. I was interested to hear Victoria Barr's statements about this area being managed for multiple use. Well, it's unclear to me how you can have balanced use of the resources in that landscape when 91% of the area has already been leased and you already have 40,000 oil and gas wells on the landscape. I'm not aware of a single instance where BLM has gone through a drilling permit process or a leasing process and they determined, you know what, no, this is actually inappropriate to lease in a particular area or inappropriate to approve a drilling permit. Instead, they might shuffle the deck chairs around a little bit, but again, it's a runaway freight train. And the other point I would make, too, on this front is that, yes, BLM is moving through this planning process, but they put the cart before the horse. They have been approving leases, executing leases, and giving oil and gas companies lease rights, approving oil and gas drilling permits on those leases, and considering things such as the Piñon pipeline. And then they decide later on, well, oh, maybe we need a plan for this. The plan needs to come first. And so BLM has a massive credibility problem in play here. And I think Standing Rock has energized the community, and I think you'll see that energy spill over into the San Juan Basin and the greater Chaco landscape.
I'm going to let Victoria, Teresa wanted to say something real quick, but then I want to let Victoria respond to that. Go ahead. Oh, go ahead, Teresa.
Well, I also wanted to add to that the caller, I believe, is striking a point here. The tribes over numerous years, even like I said, during my tenure as a historic preservation officer, has been trying to have these conversations with the Farmington BLM. We've tried to get the Farmington BLM to understand the significance of the area, the cumulative impacts that oil and gas will have on a very delicate landscape. We've also indicated over the years from the Pueblo of ACOMA that it is not just the cultural significance, but what happens when you have a multitude of these development projects that are simply erasing the chapters of our history. For many of our tribal communities, our history is not written. It remains in the landscape. These are places that we go to visit. But when development happens to, especially if you look up in the Farmington area, to that particular degree, when we can no longer have contact with the land the way it once was, it makes it very difficult to have those conversations because we know development is moving forward. BLM is telling the tribes, resources are value. We want to have that conversation. There are seemingly to be two different tracks that are occurring. And so what we really need to do is have some pushback to say, wait a minute, as the caller indicated, there are numerous developments that are happening, but the cart is seeming to get ahead of the horse here.
Okay, I want to give Victoria Barr from the Farmington District Office of the BLM a chance to respond.
Sure, just a couple of things of clarification. So just because the minerals have been leased, that doesn't exclude surface use or multiple use. So we have several areas where we've had oil and gas wells put in from the 1950s that or 60s that could still be in operation, where we also have recreational opportunities. We have grazing permit operations. We have other rights of ways that we're processing. We have habitat restoration projects. We're actually working on right now a large project to enhance mule deer winter habitat range. And so just because something's leased doesn't mean that that's like the sole purpose for that area. We look at potential conflicts of multiple use and we try to mitigate that through our NEPA process. Also, the number of wells is a little bit fewer than what the caller indicated. It's more roughly about 19,000 to 20,000 wells.
Now, I do want to say you're working, part of these meetings you had were to create a master development plan, leasing plan?
No, not necessarily. Okay. So we received from an NGO a proposal for a master leasing plan, and we'll be analyzing that in our range of alternatives for the EIS. So we will have
the environmental impact statement.
Yes. Okay. So we are analyzing a wide range of alternatives in that environmental impact statement. And one of those alternatives may incorporate elements of that master leasing plan. Other things to think about. So the history of the San Juan Basin, some of those leases go back to the 1920s. And so, we have to follow what federal law has stated on how to manage those mineral leases. And so once the government made a contract to lease those minerals, we have to uphold that contract. So if a mineral's been leased and we receive an application for a permit to drill and say no, the United States government can be sued under takings under the U.S. Constitution, which is why now when we decide whether or not to lease an area, we take a hard look at that. And in fact, the 2003 RMP did close certain areas to fluid mineral leasing because of cultural resource values.
I want to just go to Eric real quick with the Western Environmental Law Center because we're almost out of time. OPEC has said it's going to curtail production in an effort to boost oil prices globally. We also have a plan being floated by the land commissioner that would transfer some federal mineral rights to the state as an effort to create a fund for early childhood development. I'm wondering what this all means for oil and gas production here, and what we might see in the West as an aftermath of the Standing Rock protests and the new administration committing more demonstrations, more lawsuits.
Yeah, let me say first that Victoria's statements are a little bit Orwellian because many of those leases have been issued in the past 10 years. So certainly there are older leases that are in play, but the BLM has issued many leases in recent years. So it's a bit Orwellian what she's saying. Okay. In terms of the broader context, there's been a massive failure of leadership in terms of investing in the San Juan Basin and providing tools to the communities so that they can transition away from fossil fuels. Agencies like the BLM essentially give the communities no choice. Either you can can continue to live in a situation where your community is impoverished because there's very little economic development, or you can take oil and gas development. No one, whether it's BLM, BIA, or whether it's political leadership in Congress, is providing tools to these communities.
Okay.
And so we're faced with these dynamics where you get oil and gas drilling pushed down people's throat.
Okay. I thank you, Eric Schlenker-Goodrich from the Western Environmental Law Center, Victoria Barr from the Farmington District Manager for the Bureau of Land Management, and John Halliday from the Bureau of Indian Affairs, Laura Paskus, independent journalist, and Teresa Pascal from Acoma Pueblo. Thank you all for joining us today. You can continue the conversation on Twitter with KUNM News. Also, share your comments on the KUNM call-in show page at KUNM.org. There's resources there as well and links to our guests. Our engineer today was Roman Garcia. Sarah Trujillo was live tweeting. Anna Landy helped on production. Elaine Baumgartel is our executive producer. Next week on the call-in show, we'll look at marijuana and the economy. Will lawmakers consider legislation to allow recreational cannabis sales like Colorado? That's next week here on the KUNM call-in show. I'm Megan Kamrick. Thanks for joining us.